Session number 12439.
Magis Emerilto.
And so we had to teach them all rifle, sexual training, company training, and it developed eventually to battalion exercises and even brigade exercise at the very end. We'd started, if you remember, I think I said before, in when I arrived, which was September 43, and we were launched into battle in June 44. So we had just about a year, or no, less than a year, to form an efficient fighting battalion. We were out on two exercises at night, moving around the countryside, lugging our equipment, attacking positions, digging in. Two nightly exercises a week, including weekends. We did have the odd weekend off, but they were rare. So when the time came eventually and the battalion was... And we had quite a number of parachute exercises, which was quite good. I mean, the aircraft was available. There were Stirlings and Albemarles and Valettas, all sorts of different aircraft which we jumped out of, which were spare to us. And we had battalion night drops in the Salisbury Plain area and the odd brigade exercises as well. So we were really put through our paces. And one of the hardest physical tests that we had to do, we all had to go through, even for the CO, was a 50-mile march in full fighting order, carrying all our weapons and all our ammunition and shells and mortar bombs and so on, 50 miles within 24 hours. And most of us did, the companies did it in turn, and the average was 22 hours. 50 miles in 22 hours, so carrying all our equipment, lugging our machine guns and mortars. The rifleman, of course, you see, wasn't... He didn't only have to carry his own weapon and his own ammunition for his rifle, but also had to carry mortar bombs and machine gun belts for the other platoon in the support company. Well, then the time came when D-Day approached and the 6th Airborne Div was selected. The 1st Airborne Div, incidentally, had come back from North Africa. They'd done the Sicily show and they landed in Italy and got sort of a third of the way up Italy when Monty brought them back to England. And they were established in East Anglia, Cambridgeshire, Lincolnshire, and so on. And we did have an exercise before D-Day between the two divisions. We did a simulated night jump in the area around Oxford, Farringdon Way, we scattered our soldiers and covered lorries amongst the fields and everywhere, and in the middle of the night, and at the appointed time, we all, so to speak, rose from the fields as if we had landed at night in that area, and we had to go through our drill of finding out where in the hell we were, because... And to get to the correct rendezvous, which was quite a task because there were no signposts on roads and lanes in those days. We had to find out where in the hell we were and then do a compass march to the rendezvous. Having done that, we then marched to a defensive locality, a ridge, where we dug ourselves in before dawn. And the 1st Airborne Div from East Anglia did an actual daylight parachute jump outside our area, but near us, with the aim to attack us. And this was quite a big exercise. It was quite interesting. I think it was called Exercise Mush. That was just before D-Day. And we'd like to think, of course, the 6th Airborne Div, that we had proved ourselves a better division than the 1st Airborne Div, although they'd had battle experience in Africa and so on, and that we had been selected to do the Normandy, the D-Day operation. Our morale was high. You can imagine this tremendous adventure coming towards us. Well, about a week before our before D-Day, we left our barracks in Larkhill area and we went to our respective airfields into hutted and tented camps adjacent to the airfield from which we were going to take off. And our battalion went to RAF Keevil, which is, I think, in Somerset area. It's just west of Bath, Keevil. And we were established in a barbed wire enclosed camp, waiting for our operation orders to be briefed. No one was to allow, we could write letters, but no letters were going to go home until we had departed. We exercised ourselves. We played cricket in the encampment area. We went out for the odd march, control march, no contact with civilians outside the camp area. We were taken by lorries to the airfield adjacent to the hangars to collect our chutes and to adjust our chutes and put our names on them and put them back onto lockers, into lockers there in the hangars. We socialized with the RAF pilots, like there were, we entertained the RAF officers in our mess and of an evening dinner, and they did us, so that we got to know the RAF crew reasonably well in such a short time. And in the camp, when the time came, we were briefed for our tasks on the landing in Normandy. Stage by stage, first of all, the commanding officers went and got briefed, and then company commanders, and then platoon commanders, and then we had our own men to ourselves in a briefing hut where there was a cloth model layout of the Normandy coast, Caen, the River Orne, and the canal, and what we were going to do. We were extremely well briefed. Officers were given little aerial photographs of the area that we were going to operate in. And so we were able to have a picture in our mind of the ground. We didn't need maps at all. I didn't use a map at all. When I got there, I had a vivid picture of the ground that we were going to operate on. Then the time came. This fortnight, it was about a fortnight in at the end of May when we were in our camps outside Keevil, and it was a rest. We really needed it. We were able to unwind. Some may think that we were overtrained. We were sort of almost physically exhausted with marching and exercises and the like. And we were able to completely relax in wonderful weather. The sun shone. It was lovely and warm. And we were able to idle the days away and waiting for our turn to be briefed. And when the time came for us to leave, we were excited to leave the camp and to go to emplane on the 4th of June, when we were suddenly told that the whole thing had been cancelled and it was going to be delayed for 24 hours. So I can't remember what stage it was when we were told to return back, but I don't think we'd left our camp. Some had already gone to the airfield.
Did it affect morale?
Not a bit, no. I think in those days, you know, that we took everything in our stride and we weren't sort of too much excited about it. We knew it was going to happen. We'd been used to exercises when we were supposed to emplane and we could for a drop and it had to be cancelled because of the weather or something like that. I mean, cancellation to us of emplaning and doing a parachute drop was quite common because of the weather. So we just took this in our stride. And indeed, I think most of us didn't feel anything more about this operation than an exercise, like so many parachute exercises we'd done. We had our general around, Brigadier Poet, who was our Brigadier, and General Gale, he'd come around and given us tremendous enthusiastic pep talks about how we were going to put paid to the Germans, how we were going to win, how we were going to carry out our duties, and the Germans haven't got a hope, and all that, you know. Our morale was extremely high in the way our senior officers spoke so confidently in what we were going to do and how we were going to succeed. But I think I personally sort of didn't feel that anything more than I felt as if I was going on an exercise. The drill was all the same, exactly the same as going on an airborne exercise, a parachute exercise. Then the day, then the evening did come, the evening of June the 5th, when we got into our lorries and were transported to the airfield. We collected our chutes and our lorries took us around the perimeter, right around miles away into the country, where our aircraft had been dispersed to the dispersal areas of the aircraft. And the aircraft that we, the battalion, were going to jump out of was the Stirling, which was used to be a bomber, but coughed up by the area by Bomber Command for us to use in the airborne role. And we were just dumped by our aircraft, the Stirling, onto the grass there. And we were right out in the countryside, away from the hangars, peaceful June evening, lovely and calm. And we just sat and talked for a while amongst ourselves. And then the Padre came whipping up, Joe Jenkins, in his Jeep. And we had a little service, had a little prayer. And he wished us well, and then he dashed off again to another aircraft over the little crest of the hill, out of sight from us. And then came the two jeeps, or no, one jeep of the RAF crew, roaring up, and they got out and they said, "All right, you chaps, don't you worry, piece of cake, we'll get you there." You know, it was tremendous sort of a light-hearted, excited sort of atmosphere, spirit. And then the time came when we were ordered to emplane, and we emplaned under the belly of the aircraft through the hole. The hole wasn't a circular hole of the Stirling, it was a coffin-shaped hole, oblong. So, and in the Stirling, one was able to stand up, which was rather nice. But there were no seats. So 17 of us, that was the numbers that the Stirling took, entered the aircraft in reverse order of our jumping out, the aperture being at the stern end of the aircraft, and I jumped number one, and so I was the last in. And the doors was closed. And then we sat. It was getting dark now, and it was quite dark inside the aircraft. We sat on the floor with our backs to the windows. There weren't any, I'm sorry, the backs to the fuselage. And it was dark. There were only about six little red lights along the fuselage side. And there was nothing else to do but sit. And we couldn't talk to each other because of the roar of the aircraft engines. Made it possible. But the engine started up, roared away, and we taxied around for a while till we got to the end of the runway. Sorry, got to the end of the runway, and we took off. And we were going to be in the air, so we were told, about an hour and a half. And there was the roar of the aircraft. And we had had exciting days. There was a lot to do that day, you know, getting things ready and getting dressed and packing up our personal kit, sending letters off in the post and then drawing chutes and so on. So I think most of us were pretty tired. And I went to sleep. and quite a number of others did too. But then, at the appropriate time, a member of the crew came down from the cockpit area and woke me up and said something like, 20 minutes to go, sir. Help me open the door. And I didn't know how to open, hadn't been trained to open up the two flaps, doors of the coffin-shaped hole. He did one side and attached the door, the long oblong door, to the side of the fuselage, and I was astride the hole in the dark, fiddling with the hooks to try and find the hooks to fix the door back against the fuselage. And there I was astride the door and looking down, with the roar of the aircraft becoming much louder and the wind coming up through the aperture, hitting me around the legs and so on. And looking down, I saw the sea. And suddenly I remember, good heavens, I'm not hooked up. If anything happened, I'd be out in a flash. So I got out of that position pretty quick. Well, we went through the drill of getting ready for jumping out of the aircraft, hooking ourselves up, our static lines up to the wire. It went along the length of the fuselage on the roof, and checking each other's equipment and everything. And then when there was about 5 minutes to go, we all moved up closer. I astride the door, looking down, and I hoped to see some of the task force, the shipping, the armada, but I didn't see any ship at all, and just the white waved, speckly waved tops of the sea below me. And then suddenly I saw the parallel lines of the waves coming ashore on a sort of dark yellow beach, and then a cliff, and then woods and copses and hedgerows of the land below me, only about 800 feet below me. And it was a reasonably moonlight night, not full moon, so I was able to see the ground quite easily. And then red light on, green light, and I jumped through the hole. The roar of the engine and the whish of the wind around one's body all happened suddenly, and then quietness. And like any exercise in England, I found myself floating down quietly to a field, and quite close a horse was grazing, and I landed without any harm in the field, and I heard other people landing around me. Well, having got out of my harness, I reckoned that I was being dropped on the right spot, and I shouted for any men who happened to be landing around me and could hear me. So I gathered up a little group of about four, and my batman, who was jumping number two, was one of them. And together with my compass, we marched off westwards towards the rendezvous. And I had no difficulty in getting to the battalion rendezvous, which was a quarry on the west side of our dropping zone, quarry near the River Orne. And when I reached the quarry, my company commander, Major Stevens, said, there are only about 12 arrived so far, and the IO adjutant hasn't arrived with the Aldous lamp, which was a red filter, which was our rallying sign for our own men off the dropping zone, that I was to go onto the dropping zone and take over his job. Have you got a torch with a red filter? So I said, yes, I have. So back I went onto the dropping zone, and I got onto a little mound, a little hillock in the dropping zone, rise of ground, and flashed my torch around the area, hoping that our men would see the light and come towards me, and then I dispatched them to the battalion rendezvous quarry. Very few people came in the hour that I was there. We did have a little alarm in that from Coburg way. Our quarry was quite close to the road, was on the edge of the road that went from Coburg down south to the bridges, to the Pegasus Bridge. And we had a staff car coming down, German staff car. That was shot up, and a dispatch rider. And the battalion, the lads in the quarry started shooting as it came whipping by, And of course, I had all the bullets whipping around me on the dropping zone, the ones going by the staff car. So had a bit of a hairy moment then when I hugged the ground hard with bullets from our own chaps whipping over my head as they tried to engage the staff car and the dispatch rider. We didn't get him, them, but they were shot up and the passengers killed further down the road where the 7th Battalion were rendezvousing. The 7th Battalion had a bugle to rendezvous their lads by the copse on the edge of the dropping zone. The 13th Battalion had a hunting horn, but we, the 12th, had the red light. Well, after 2 hours of waiting, we landed about midnight. After 2 hours, about 2 o'clock in the morning, the company commander said to me, "The CO can't wait any longer. We're to move off." C Company. I was second in command of C Company, captain. Then. That the IO, intelligence officer, hadn't come, and that I was to lead the battalion to our defensive locality. This is a task I hadn't been briefed to do, but as I said, we had pored over our aerial photographs, and I knew the way, very vividly in my mind. So we quietly went off in single file, with me leading. Down the road towards the Pegasus Bridge, the two bridges, but just short of the River Orne Bridge, there was a little lane going left, going southward left, and this was our route to our positions, which was on the south side of Ronville. We were going to establish a defensive position facing Caen on the east side of the two of the rivers, Orne, with C Company on the right, with its right flank on the River Orne, B Company on the left of C Company, and A Company in reserve in Le Bar de Ronville. And so it was pretty eerie because going off the road into this little country track, really, with high hedgerows on the right-hand side, 2 o'clock in the morning, it was quite dark. It was like going into a dark tunnel. But fortunately, there was no enemy around, and we just carried on quietly as we'd done so many exercises in England in single file to our objective, our defense position. And this we did without any trouble, skirting around the chateau wall, which was on the chateau being on our left, of the Le Bar of Ronville. And so we came to the dispersal area where the companies wheeled off to their respective defensive localities to start digging in. Well, when we left the dropping zone, our rendezvous, we were extremely alarmed because C Company had only 30 men and we were very short in numbers. But the CO said we couldn't stay there much longer. We were already waiting for 2 hours, that we had to get cracking. But when we reached our defensive position, south of the Le Bar de Ronville, to our delight, we found a hell of a lot of chaps, our chaps there, already established and digging in like mad. Such was our briefing in England that every soldier knew exactly where he's going to dig his hole and his arcs of fire. It was so clear on the aerial photographs. And so there was no briefing required. The soldier went straight to his little area and started digging in. And the bulk of the battalion were there already digging in. They had been scattered in their drop beyond the dropping zone. And with all this kit that they had to carry, they weren't going to flog all the way back to the rendezvous of the dropping zone and then flog back again to the defensive locality. So they took a shortcut and got themselves established in their section and platoon positions. Every man knew from our briefing back in England exactly where they were going to dig their personal trench and the arcs of fire in front of them. Well, I had a special job to do forward of C Company with on a hedgerow about 300 yards forward of the company forward defensive locality. But before I went off to my positions, I was told by Major Stevenson to clear a group of four houses about 50 yards away to see if, whether there were any enemy in those houses, because that was where battalion headquarters were going to establish themselves. So I gathered a sergeant who happened to be standing nearby and two soldiers, and in the dark, it was now about 2 o'clock in the morning, still dark, I went up a little lane and to the first of the four houses, I knocked at the door of the first house. And after some time, the door was opened, and a middle-aged lady, dressed in her day clothes, not in her nightie or anything, opened the door and looked very frighteningly at me, because we were all camouflaged up with darkened faces and scrim nets on our helmets, we must have looked a terrifying sight to her. Anyway, I looked past her, and there was her husband standing at the foot of the stairs and a couple of kids. They were all in their day clothes, which was rather a strange thing at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I then started to speak to her. And I wasn't very good at French, was hopeless at French at school, but anyway, I had a go, and this is how it went. I saluted her, and I said, "Bonjour, madame, nous sommes soldats, nous anglais, nous arrivons ici par avion, parachutis. L'heure de libération est arrivée. Où est les soldats allemands? Ils restent ici, n'est-ce pas?" I thought that was brilliant, you know, getting through that, and she looked blankly at me, and frighteningly still. And I thrust a pamphlet into her hands. We were issued with little pamphlets in French to inform the civilians that this was not a raid, this was indeed D-Day, and that the battles were going to rage around them, and that they'd be safer if they stayed in their cellars. So I gave her this little pamphlet, and she glanced at that. And then I started again. I said, "Madame, nous sommes soldats anglais. Où est les soldats allemands?" And she still looked blankly at me. And then I spoke to my sergeant behind me. I said, "Can you speak this wretched language, sergeant?" And spoke to my two soldiers as well. And of course they couldn't. And after this little conversation, I started again a third time to get this across to her. And then suddenly,